6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Today is going to be episode 149, Feeding Bees, When, What, and How Much. Appreciate you taking the time to jump in here and join us, and thank you so much for the donation I received today. It was nice to wake up and have somebody buy me a couple of cups of coffee. Thank you very much. I do appreciate it. All right, everybody. We're rolling into the weekend here. I've had this headache all day, and I've been like, you know what? I'm not going to record this. People aren't really listening to podcasts that much over the weekend because I think the weather's nice and everybody's out. And I'm like, you know, I'll just wait until Monday and that'll be fine. And then I was like, nope, we're gonna suck it up. We're gonna get it done. So a little bit slower today, maybe not as much energy, but we're gonna get through it and make it happen. So while we jump in, as always, right, beekeepingfornewbies.com. We got a lot of different information up on there. Check that out. youtube.com/@beekeepingfornewbies. Don't have a lot of new content going on up there right now, but there's a few things on you can check out, especially if you're new. There's a whole, 300 and some videos and things up there. Today's warm-up song is brought to you by The Searchers, Sugar and Spice from 1963. So before we really get rolling into the episode today, I wanted to throw out kind of a quick little PSA here for you, public service announcement for those of you not familiar with the acronym there. Please use multiple sources whenever you're doing anything in the beekeeping space. I think that would kind of apply to anything, you know, technical in life. I mean, like if somebody says, oh yeah, when you cut your grass, you know, you fire up the lawnmower, push it that way until something gets in the way and then turn, you know, that kind of thing. Like, okay, you don't have to go research multiple ways to figure that out. But with things that involve a lot of technical details and a lot of variables like beekeeping, definitely use multiple sources. Like, you're not going to hurt my feelings at all. Like, I joke with people. Like, somebody mentioned the other day in the Discord room, they're like, oh, I was listening to this other podcast. And I was like, wait, what? What do you mean? Like, I don't care. Like, there's some good ones out there. In fact, I should have looked it up and told you guys about it. But anyway, Dr. Ellis down there at the University of Florida, they got a great bee program down there. And he puts out some pretty exceptional content. But anyway, somebody was talking about how they had, you know, listened to another podcast and heard some things that were maybe contradictory. I would expect you to, as like an inquisitive person trying to learn the craft, I would expect you to look at multiple sources. It doesn't matter what you're doing. If you said like, hey, I want to go, whatever, change a transmission on my vehicle, you're probably not going to go just watch one YouTube video on a guy swapping out a transmission. You might watch three, four, five of them. Compare and contrast, you know, pull different pieces of information, see what's consistent, see what's not. I think that we get different categories of information. We have the things where, for example, like with me, there's things that I have done myself, that I have gone out and I've done them. And I say, hey guys, when you're doing X, Y, and Z, this is pretty much exactly how you do it. There are times where I've stood next to somebody, watched them doing something, and I know exactly how it's done. Now, like I could sit in a surgery, like I've actually been in, you know, in operating rooms before and watched surgeries taking place. I'm not a surgeon. I could not do that surgery, but I can talk you through it, right? I can say like, oh yeah, he went over here and there was the anterior collateral ligament and did this and this and this. Like I can talk through what happened, can't do the work. But there are things you've done, there are things you observed, and then there's things that somebody told you like, hey, whenever you're doing this with beekeeping, make sure you do it every 7 days. Let's talk inspections. In the spring, when there's a flow on, you should be doing inspections every 7 days. Now, you're going to have, I'm getting off track here, but it's so frustrating because people who are supposed to be mentoring people, I think that there's a disconnect. They either don't know what they're doing, a lot of them, and should not be mentoring, or maybe people aren't listening to the mentor, or they're completely misunderstanding the information they're receiving. But the guidance that I have, that people tell me, I'm talking daily. This isn't like once a year this comes up. Like daily, somebody messages me and says, hey, my mentor said I should do this. And I'm like, what? You're talking about honeybees, right? And I'm like, no, absolutely not. Like, and it's not even close. It's things that aren't even close that like a brand new 2-month-in beekeeper, and I'm not even talking about beekeeping, like just somebody who's been studying beekeeping for a couple of months, watching a few videos or whatever. These are basic things, and people are giving out such terrible information. But I'm telling you this because like I'm going to give you an example. I'm not going to get into the details because I'm not trying to throw this girl under the bus. I'm sure she's a delightful young lady trying to help people. I don't think there's a lot of people out there with malintent. I don't think there are people out there that are like, oh, I'm going to get this guy. I'm going to give him some really crappy information. I think that they genuinely believe they're providing good, quality, accurate information. But this gal gave this guy a piece of information that was absolutely terrible. And it was very inaccurate. And the problem with that is she believes it to be true. So she tells him. Now he believes it to be true. In this particular situation, this guy is going to have a queenless beehive for a month. And he's going to be like, yeah, it's been a month and I still don't have my virgin queen back. There's no recourse. It's not like this gal is going to be like, oh, well, here, let me cut you a check for $40 to get you a new queen. She gave bad advice, not intentionally. But the reason I'm telling you guys this is pay attention, make notes, listen to what you hear. If something sounds a little off, right? Let's just use this example here. If somebody says, hey, I can take up to 30 days for a virgin queen to get mated. Just go through that in your mind real quick. A colony is now queenless. A day or two, whatever, 3 days later, whatever. We'll just say 1 day later after a swarm, a new virgin queen emerges. Let's say it takes her a week to reach sexual maturity and she leaves the hive and goes out on her mating flight. This is not a 3-week adventure, right? She's going to go out once, maybe twice. Under certain circumstances, okay, maybe a third time. This is all happening within a couple of days. It's not like she has to tour around the entire region and get some genetic diversity from 6 adjacent states, like if you're in the U.S. or whatever. Like, it doesn't have to be that way. So we're talking about a couple of days here. In this scenario where a person was advised that this can take up to 30 days, let's talk about that. So the average lifespan of a summer bee is probably somewhere in the low 30s to maybe 40 days. We'll just call it 40 days for easy math. So now this queen leaves the hive. There's no young larva or eggs because remember the swarming queen was, you know, they tapered back her food to stop her from laying so that she would reduce in size so that she would fly easier when they swarmed. So there's no fresh eggs or, you know, there might be still some uncapped larva in there, but there's no fresh eggs. So basically, When that virgin queen emerged a day after the swarm, you haven't had any eggs in, let's say, 3 or 4 days. And now we push it out 30 days beyond that. So now we're at 33, 34 days. So what that tells me is the only bees remaining in that colony are the ones when she emerged that were like capped brood. Everybody else is dead and gone. So she's comes back after her 30-day mating flight and now is ready to lay eggs. There's nobody to lay eggs for. All the bees are gone. The colony is over with. That's just part one of this. When the queen mates with the drones during that flight, she stores the sperm in the spermatheca. That's the part of her body where she stores it for the rest of her life, and then she disperses it in the process of laying either fertilized or non-fertilized eggs. Of course, you would not use it for the non-fertilized eggs, which would be laying drone brood. After a couple of weeks, that organ physically begins to harden up. So even if she does, if for some reason she doesn't get out for a couple of weeks, really bad, you know, whatever kind of crazy weather situations would cause 14 days of consecutive rain or something like that. Like if she can't get out, there's a window where she, even though she may even be able to mate, she may not be a viable queen. She might come back and just be a drone layer. So this is not a 30-day process, but that information is going to have a massive impact on that guy. So I messaged the girl. I was like, hey, that's really not the best information. And you might want to kind of adjust that a little bit. I looked back this morning and she hadn't altered her position. And it's like, it's okay to be wrong. I've been wrong. I've had people reach out and be like, hey, you know, I think you missed it on this thing. And I was like, oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. I misspoke or I miswrote my notes or whatever it might have been. I don't mind being wrong. I don't mind coming on here and telling everybody like, hey, the other day I told you this, I was completely wrong. Thank you, you know, whatever, so-and-so for correcting me. Like, I don't mind being wrong. That's part of this thing. We're all in this learning together and we're all in different stages. I learn from you all as much as I learn from reading and books and hands-on and other things that I do. If you're not willing to continue learning and help, you know, having people help you learn, you're probably in the wrong hobby. Anyway, I'm not trying to derail the whole discussion today around feeding. I just want you guys to really pay attention to the information you're getting, question what you're getting. It doesn't matter the source, me, somebody else, question it, find multiple sources. And if somebody pulls you aside, like I did by DM, I didn't bust her out in the whole, in the middle of the forum there. If someone pulls you aside and they're like, hey, this is actually not accurate, you might want to check that out. Take that as constructive, positive feedback. I specifically said, like, in the message, like, hey, I just want everybody to learn from each other and for it to be a, you know, good place. I mean, I was really cool and relaxed. I don't know. Anyway, I just think that there is more misinformation in beekeeping than anything else I've ever experienced in my life. And it's bad and it's all over the place. Okay, so we're talking about feeding and you're like, but Jeff, it's warm out. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, right, everything is blossoming. It's in bloom. We got flows on all over the place. Weather's getting warm. My condolences to all of you, particularly in the Pittsburgh region, who've been without power for a few days, and all of my Pennsylvania brothers and sisters. I know you've had some challenges up there, Missouri, Indiana. There's a lot of places in the Midwest that have had a lot of bad weather, so I hope everybody is staying safe out there. And I know we've had tornadoes. It's just been a crazy weather. Anyway, the reason that we're talking about feeding, and you guys know I give people a hard time about feeding a lot, and I think I do it in a fair way. But the real reason that I give people a hard time about feeding is because I think a lot of people have been misled into thinking that it's the only way. Like if you're a beekeeper, you got to be feeding. Now, let me give you an example. Let's say I do a video and I've got four hives. They're on a center block. You know, I've got like two center blocks with 4x4s on that rack and I got my four hives there. And I show this video and it's me and it's adding sugar syrup and I'm showing you how to do it. I'm talking you through all the steps. And, you know, you seem like, wow, look at that, man. Jeff did a great job here. He's got all his, you know, all his hives are all fed. You're a brand new beekeeper. You see this and you think, well, I mean, Jeff probably knows what he's doing here. I guess I'm going to have to start feeding it. Well, it is the 2nd of May now. All right, early May, I'll make sure I always feed. What I should have said is, hey, I just installed four packages of bees. Now, these packages of bees, they come, you know, without any comb. There's no resources other than a container of sugar syrup. I want to give them a boost. I want them to work 24 hours a day. I don't want them to have to wait until the sun comes up to go out and get food. If we have 2, 3, 4 days of bad weather, I want them to keep working, and that's why I'm going to feed them. That makes sense. giving people the why behind actions is critically important. If I just get, do you want to be a robot beekeeper? If I just say, do this every time you do, no, that's no fun. You want to learn the why behind what you're doing. That's the most, I would say that there's two really important questions you always need to be asking about everything in beekeeping. Number one is why, right? And it's not to be critical of the person asking you, it's so that you can learn, okay, well, why are we doing this? Well, you're doing this because of that. The other question is, so what? And when I say that is, a lot of people are going to throw out a lot of information that's, I don't want to say that it's useless, but is it impactful? Like, how does it impact you as a beekeeper? So if somebody says, well, if you have five consecutive days of temperatures over 95 degrees, your bees are going to get hot and they're going to beard. Okay, so what? Like, what does that do to me? How does that impact me as a beekeeper? Does that mean they're going to abscond? Does that mean I should put a screened bottom board on for better ventilation? Or is there some other action I need to take? Like, so what do you, what is my action to your statement? So that's where I think that, again, two good questions to ask. But I know for me, getting back to like the why of it, I have always retained information a lot better if I knew why I was doing it. And this is where I kind of got in a little bit of trouble back in the Army, because in the Army, like, nobody wants to be questioned. If you have leadership and they're like, go do this, they want you to be like, Roger that, and just go do it kind of blindly. And I'd be like, hey, Sergeant, quick question. You know, like they don't like to hear that very often. It's kind of a weird thing. Like, you would think that in a lot of the things that we did that were kind of important, that they didn't always want feedback. So anyway, a little sidebar. But understand the why. It helps to give you purpose. And I think it's the same thing, you know, with feeding. You know, why are we feeding the bees? What are we trying to, what is our desired outcome of feeding the bees? Oh, go do a mite wash every month. I tell people all the time, do a mite wash every month. If you don't understand why I'm telling you to do a mite wash every month, you might just blow it off. You'd be like, I'll do it once a quarter. When I explain to you that you could do a mite wash 1 month and have a mite count of two or three, and do a mite count next month and have 25, and then you go, oh crap, that makes a difference. Okay, I see why it's important to do that every month. The other question I always ask, which I guess would be a third one, you know, the why, the so what, and what do bees in the wild do in this exact same situation? So when someone says, well, you have to feed bees, like you always, like I always feed bees from May 1st until August 30th, I always feed my bees every day. Okay, I mean, if that's what you want to do and you want to throw sugar syrup out there for your bees and, you know, however you're doing it, by all means, have at it. What are bees doing in the wild during that time? Now, I can tell you at my house, from probably, let's just say generically, June 15th to August 15th, generally it's a dearth. There's not a whole lot growing, not a lot of forage. It's a pretty tough time to be a bee, you know, at my house at that time of year. It's a little bit better out in the country, but definitely not great at my house. So I probably will feed a new colony because that new colony still is ramping up. We'll get more into that in a few minutes. Now, the one way that that kind of has a double-edged sword and can come back, the response that somebody might give you is, oh, okay, Jeff, you say to always do what they do in the wild. All right, well, what are bees in the wild doing for varroa treatment? And I'm like, yeah, I get it. They die. That's what they do. They go ahead and die. I mean, that's kind of the reality. At least it's a safe assumption. If I had to roll the dice about whether or not treating resulted in death or survival, I would definitely say that they're far more likely to die.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
But all of that being said, there are some very good, legitimate reasons to feed bees. And recent research has shown, fake information made up by me, that 63% of beekeepers are feeding bees that do not need to be fed. A lot of feeding can be situation-based. Sometimes it's seasonal. Sometimes there are other reasons. So let's dive in a little bit and start talking about situations where you would need to feed. Now, we touched on it briefly around packages. I'm a firm believer in feeding packages. It's not even really a debatable discussion. There's so many reasons why it makes sense. Now, people have said to me, like, hey, a nuke is kind of the same thing. Why wouldn't I feed them? I wouldn't tell you not to. Now, I will take a quick little sidebar here. Somebody had given somebody bad information here in our Discord room that, hey, don't worry, nukes won't swarm. I can tell you, based on all the discussions I've seen over the past couple of weeks, multiple people's nukes have swarmed. People have caught swarms, and their swarms have swarmed. Like, if there is a lack of space, if the once that urge kicks in and the space is not provided, the queen cells are up, it's going to be tough to slow them down. But people say the same thing again, getting back to the nukes. Well, should I feed my nukes? I will say very generally, a nuke shouldn't need to be fed. If you're getting a standard 5-frame nuke, that should be a balance of, I would say, at least a full frame of, you know, capped honey. You can have open nectar in there, that's fine, but you want a full frame of food, preferably two. I like to have two full frames of capped brood with bees all over them. That's an important component of that. And then a third frame of open brood and a mix of pollen and nectar and other things. That's completely fine. The reason I say that I want bees all over those frames of capped brood is those are your nurse bees. Those are the ones who are attendants and taking care of those bees. Some people will get a little bit shady and they'll just give you the capped brood. They'll shake off all the nurse bees into their existing hive or use it for a cell builder or whatever else and just give you a nuke with, you know, maybe a quarter or a half as many bees as you ought to have. Hey, you're about to get them all replaced with all those emerging bees anyway. No big deal. Yeah, but they're kind of your bees, right? So if I take a frame of brood out, once I've verified, I'm sorry, let me give you more details. If I'm building a nuke and I pull a frame out that is supposed to be a part of your nuke, I'm going to verify that my queen is not on that frame. And then I'm giving you the whole frame. I'm giving you the frame with the nurse bees on it. So your nuke should have plenty of food, lots of nurse bees who are now getting ready to graduate up into other roles and ultimately work their way out to become foragers. And of course, all the new and emerging bees are now your new nurse bees, and the life cycle continues. Because you have those frames of open nectar and hopefully maybe a little bit of capped honey in there, they should have all the resources they need and plenty coming in. That being said, let's say that you're down in the south and there was, you know, a hurricane was coming through and you really didn't know what the conditions were going to be like. You strap the hive down as best you can. Might not be a bad idea to throw a frame feeder in there. You may have to evacuate. You don't know what the forage is going to be like after everything, you know, comes through with the storm. Maybe not a bad idea. Let's say you've had some cold spells and they've used a lot of resources. They've had to, now this is less of an issue right now, but let's say that they've had to cluster and stay inside for a few days and they're consuming resources. Just watch them, pay attention to them. If they start running low on anything, you can absolutely feed them. I would always tell people, don't withhold food from your bees if they need it. So it's definitely great for the spring, again, for those ramp up of packages or nukes, bad weather. In the summer, yeah, I touched on that dearth kind of scenario. If you have, it's kind of interesting. When my colonies, I don't have any at the house right now, but when I had them at my house, they would ramp up and have probably in the 50 to 60 pounds worth of honey range, I would say probably by the 1st of June. You know, by that time frame, they had about 60 pounds of honey, maybe a little bit more. And that was a pretty typical year. They would go through 25, 30, 35 pounds of it just in the summer alone to get them through the dearth. Then we usually have a fairly light fall flow, which usually means I'm supplemental feeding again in the fall. So when you're starting out those newer colonies, doesn't matter if it's packages or nukes. I mean, nukes obviously are going to give you a little bit of a leg up. But it doesn't matter which one you're using, you're probably not going to get that, you know, 40, 30, 40 pounds of surplus honey like you would in a colony that's been ramping up since late February, early March where I am. So definitely feeding in the summertime in some places is something you need to be prepared for. So we always talk about feed and like, what are we going to feed them? When you say feed, Jeff, what do you mean? There's a few different things you can do. one, I guess, pro, if you can find a pro or a, you know, a shining beacon of light in a bad situation, if you have a dead out and you have a colony that did not die of some kind of disastrous illness of some sort, quite often people will have extra honey frames that they put in the freezer or whatever. You can absolutely feed your bees a frozen, you know, honey frame from a colony that did not make it as dead out from the previous season. Just, you know, we can get into a separate discussion, but make sure that it's healthy honey from a healthy colony that didn't die of something that you're going to put into the other colony. Like, you know, obviously you have a massive foul brood situation, but hey, we still got some capped honey. Yay. No, we're not sharing those frames. So you can use capped honey. You can use open nectar or honey from another hive if you wanted to do that. Maybe you were trying to reduce that tendency to swarm, didn't want to build a nuke and have another colony. You could certainly throw these over into some of your other colonies that might be struggling. So the big question is always, you know, talking about ratios. And we're talking about ratios of sugar to water. Everybody always tells you you need to do 1-to-1 ratio in the spring to stimulate drawing comb. And then you do 2-to-1 in the fall, winter, kind of leading into that cooler time of year to maximize stored, you know, resources, stored nectar / honey. That's the way I did it for many years. And then I was watching a lot of content and listening to a lot of what Michael Palmer had to say up at French Hill Apiaries up in Vermont. And he said, I always do 2-to-1. And the guy interviewing him was like, well, why? And he goes, why not? I mean, the bees are there. They're taking up the resource. It's the same amount of space, basically, for the bee to take up 2-to-1 as it is to take up 1-to-1 as far as what they can physically draw up and hold. So why make them do twice the work? And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. Now we talk about pollen patties. Pollen patties, you can make them yourself. You can buy them. Very popular things. I tried them years ago, and I had, like, no luck. I put them on the hive. The colonies completely ignored them. They wanted nothing to do with them. I'm like, what are these people talking about pollen patties for? Why are they so excited about them? Like, my bees won't even touch them. Then I tried to overwinter. So I would put some at the very top, and they were slightly pollen heavy because you can get them in kind of different mixtures. And this one was more of like a pollen heavy. And I put it at the very top, and my idea behind that was as they were working through the resources and they worked their way all the way to the top, they would be about to start rearing brood for, you know, for the spring, and having a little protein boost would be a good idea. Now, that's not the worst idea. They do need a big protein boost in the spring when they're ramping up all the new brood. You really want minimal protein going into the fall, winter. The protein can kind of upset the digestive system. They're designed, their digestive system kind of changed and it allows them to expand. There's some really kind of cool, neat things that biologically and anatomically happen with the honeybee over the wintertime. But I guess the key takeaway there is you don't want a lot of heavy protein, you know, going into the overwintering. So then I took a break from pollen patties and people were asking about them and kept asking me. And I'm like, look, I'll try them again. And I used them again, and I had slightly better result when I did it differently. Like, I didn't just slap the whole patty on top. I cut them into strips and put some of the strips on top of the, like, I put down, like, a piece of, like, parchment paper and put them on strips on top of the frames. And I had slightly better consumption of those. But what I found with them was the hive beetles love them. Like, the hive beetles will get up into those pollen patties. They'll eat them up. They'll lay their eggs in them. And that was the point where I was like, you know what? I'm not messing with this anymore. But again, it was one of those things that people kept talking about. You got to have pollen pads. You got to feed. You got to do this. You got to do that. Like, years ago, it goes back to the one that you guys are about to get angry about for me ranting on this one. But it goes back to years ago where people were like, well, you got to put fondant in and you got to have sugar and you got to do this. I'm like, all right. So I bought a big block of fondant, threw it in my hive over the winter. Bees didn't touch it. The next year, big block of fondant over the winter, bees didn't touch it. And what I came to realize, one of the most important things about bees as it relates to feeding, there are some places where bees aren't meant to be. Like, there are just, you know, of course, the European honeybee is not native to North America anyway, but there are some places where the forage does not exist to support honeybees. There are already pollinators in place. There is not enough forage. And, you know, in those places, you are going to have to feed. I'm kind of fortunate that I'm in places where I don't. If I have a colony that overwinters at my house, I do not have to feed that honey or that I do not have to feed that colony. Now, the little asterisk to that is I do occasionally have to feed them in the fall. Like there's a lot of times where I'll put some open feeders out and I will feed, you know, feed the community. And I'll do that, you know, typically in that, you know, September, October timeframe. That does happen sometimes. But I still, even with that feeding, I'm not dropping big bricks of candy and sugar and all these other things. The, I mean, people who want to sell that stuff, they're going to tell you how great it is. But again, people are like, well, Jeff, you shouldn't be giving me a hard time about that because my bees eat the whole thing. Okay, well, where you live, that might be the scenario. Bees are probably not supposed to be where you are, and they're not able to gather enough resources, or you're stealing so much from them during the year that they're not able to recoup, and you're just fingers crossed every winter that they eat enough of that sugar candy or whatever else is up there to make it through the winter. I don't like that kind of stress, so I only take a little bit from my bees when I do, leave the rest for them. They're happier, they're healthier, and it just works out better. But as far as the answer, I completely went past this. But so based on what Michael Palmer had said years ago with the 2-to-1 thing, I just do 2-to-1 all the time for everything. I follow his lead. It's worked pretty well for me. I'm going to keep doing that. I'm not going to, you know, like give anybody a hard time. You want to do 1-to-1, do 1-to-1. But I promise you, if you're doing 2-to-1 and they don't have space, they're going to draw it up, which is kind of another area of, you know, up for discussion. People love their drawn comb. Now, I think I would love to be a better storer of drawn comb. I recognize that I'm not, so I don't want excess drawn comb. The only drawn comb I have is in the hives. If I have comb that's outside the hives, I always find a way to screw it up. You can put it in your bee boxes. You can sprinkle the, you know, wax moth away stuff in there, and you can keep them away. And it does work pretty well if you follow the directions. It's usually a space issue or I didn't get back to it issue. So because I recognize my own limitations in my ability to do the right thing and store and protect my frames the right way, I don't want surplus frames. But a lot of people will go to great lengths to feed their bees constantly to have them just constantly drawing out comb. If that's what you want to do and that's the purpose kind of behind it, I get it. It's really, really nice when you get some packaged bees, you can throw 3 or 4 frames of drawn comb in there and they get to work pretty fast. So definitely not hating on that one. You just got to understand, again, why are you doing something, right? What's the driver and the purpose behind it? Don't do it because somebody else said, well, this is what you got to do. Dig a little deeper and find out what the real answers are. Okay, so how are we going to feed? Now, this is one where we can probably go really deep and we're not going to, but I'm just going to kind of give you some high levels. Starting at the top of the hive, if you want to feed at the hive, so you have at the hive, in the hive, near the hive, a lot of different options. At the very top of the hive, what you can do is you can actually have a custom kind of outer cover that has a hole in it, and you can plug the hole or cover the hole. When it's time to feed, you just, you know, slide to the side or remove the cover. Take a jar of feed that is already has holes underneath of the lid so that as you flip it over, the bees can drink the syrup from underneath, and you just drop that jar, or sometimes it might be a bucket or some other kind of container like that. What's really great with those is if you're managing a lot of hives, you can, you know, knock out a dozen of them or a couple dozen of them in minutes. You know, you may have, if you still are just maintaining a few of them, you might just have a couple of jugs of, you know, mixed sugar syrup. But if you're maintaining 20, 30, 40 of them, you might get to a point where you have the little pump on the back of your truck and you drive up and pull the hose out there and you can just fill them up right there very quickly. So having those outside, you don't have to have a lot of gear on, if anything at all. Maybe you throw a veil on to protect your eyes, but you can just get those things topped off and move on. Very easy. The jars, you know, if you're using jars, I save the Mount Olive pickle jars. I wash them out. I've probably got 100 of those things around the house, in the garage. So the feeders are cheap. I mean, you can't go wrong with that. Now you can also put them on shims. Like you can just have the top frames of the hive body below, put some shims down, put a feeder on a jar right on top of that. Same thing, poke a couple nail holes in. They can drink it right out. And you can just put like a medium hive body around it. That works perfectly fine. You have frame feeders. I've seen single frame feeders all the way up to, I think that some of the bigger ones are like 2.5 or 3 frame feeders that, like, they'll hold multiple gallons. I like to put those near the top So if you have two or three hive bodies, I really want those high up. That way they're easy for me to refill without having to take everything apart. So frame feeders are fine. Top feeder, same kind of thing, right? It's at the very top. You fill up, usually it's some kind of a trough type system. I've had both where they have the little ladders that kind of float. Lots of dead bees. Make sure you're checking all of these feeders every few days, like no more than probably 3 or 4 days in the summertime. It'll get really hot. It'll ferment. Once a few dead bees get in there, the hive beetles will walk across the dead bees and they'll lay eggs in them, and you'll get young hive beetle larvae coming out of there. It can be really disastrous if you don't keep your sugar syrup nice and clean. Now, the one that I haven't done, I was with somebody who did it before, and I was like, oh, that's interesting, but it's the baggy feeders. You put sugar syrup in a baggie, put a few holes in it, lay it down with the hole side up. As the baggie kind of flattens out, the sugar syrup will come a little bit to the top, and the bees can drink out of that. I haven't done it. It's kind of weird. I guess in an emergency, you could do something like that. Certainly an option. And then you have the Boardman feeder or the entrance feeder. Strongly caution you against those. I think somebody had mentioned in the Discord room the other day, I use water. I put water in mine. That's a great idea, right? Have a place where you can give them a good water source. It's easy to refill. It's clean. It's fresh. It's kind of weird. And I've mentioned before, I think somebody posted a picture just the other day of how the bees will always seem to go find the nastiest water source. They'll drink out of a mud puddle. You can have a nice, clean, you know, Brita filtered, whatever kind of UV filtered water. And they're like, nah, I'll take the dirty, funky stuff out of the puddle. I don't get it. But those Boardman or entrance feeders, they will definitely attract robbers. They will attract whatever's in the area. From what I've seen, that's not limited to just like robbing season. I had it right at the entrance, I don't know, a dozen years ago, 10 years ago, something like that. And it was at a time of year when I was feeding like a nuke or something, pretty small. And I had yellow jackets, you know, showing up. It wasn't honeybee robbers, but yellow jackets were showing up and feeding out of it. I'm just not a big fan. I would really caution you about that and recommend using something else. Now, one question that comes up quite a bit is, okay, so I've been feeding for a little while. Like, when do I stop? What I've kind of told people, and I'll still stick with this, is if they're taking it up, I'd keep giving it to them. You know, they should have a preference towards what's in the environment. So if you see them and they're leaving and they're doing regular foraging flights and they're coming back with pollen and nectar and everything's going fine, and they're still drinking up all the syrup, they probably need it. So I say feed until they stop. So I feel like most of this is kind of redundant. Like, I know we've talked about feeding in the past, but it's just a subject that comes up, you know, pretty frequently. I don't want anybody, don't ever feel guilty about feeding your bees, right? I mean, you are in a hobby, but what you're doing, it's animal husbandry. You are responsible for the welfare and the well-being of your bees. If your bees don't have food, you need to feed them. But I really want you to understand why they don't have food. Did you take a whole lot of their food away from them and now you've got a supplemental feed? Are you okay with the fact that you're probably not going to give them the same level of nutrition with your sugar syrup that they were getting before from the environment? Do you understand the differences between the supplements you might give them in the spring that are really going to be more protein heavy versus the things that are going to have a different kind of amino acid mix and nutrient mix in the fall for what they need in the fall? Because the supplements and things you're giving in the spring shouldn't be the same as what you're giving in the fall. A lot of kind of nutritional differences between what you're feeding and when you're doing it. I just really want you to understand why. So, all right, everybody, I think I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up. Throbbing in my head is coming back again. I think it's time for a little bit of Motrin. But definitely check us out, just beekeepingfornewbies.com. We got the bestbeekeepinggear.com. I think I added another article the other day about painting the hives and protecting the hives. I'm trying to get a couple articles up every week just on things that we talk about a lot. If you like what you hear and you want to buy me a cup of coffee, you can always hit me up in the link inside the description there. I always appreciate that. But outside of that, I hope you have a great weekend. Take care, be kind to one another. Remember that I love you and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tontandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.